Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your 2009 income tax return today. What do you think about that? Steve Schmidt, our guest. Steve is a certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. He's been a regular on our show for many years, comes by during tax season or with us by phone, as he is today, to answer your questions. And certainly, if you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve, welcome back.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Oh, just great. How are you? I imagine you're running a little busy these days.
Yes, we're getting warmed up here. You know, we haven't peaked out yet, but things are certainly getting busy.
Well, the IRS has launched its online filing system, and if you file your taxes electronically, you'll get a refund in 10 days, they say.
That's generally true, yes, if there's no processing problems. And the same is true on the state side. Refunds come fairly quickly when you electronically file. If you do it on paper, federal is probably more in the six-week range. In Wisconsin, you might even be looking upwards of 10 weeks. So if you have a nice refund, you want to get it quickly, e-filing is the way to go.
Absolutely, and I saw that the IRS has estimated it spends 24 cents to process an electronic return, but it's $2.87 per paper filing. So we're saving the government a little money and ourselves in the process by filing electronically if we can.
Exactly.
Well, Greg in De Pere has a question for you, so I want to go to Greg right away. And Greg, hello, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Basically, what I have a question is, we started a company this last year and haven't sold anything yet, but we're still in the process of getting it started up and making sure everything is good when we do actually go to sell something. Do I need to actually file taxes since only money that was done was money put into the company for product and tools to make the product? As well as what can I expect if I do file a return for this company?
When you say you filed a company or you formed a company, what type of company was it? Was it a corporation, an LLC?
LLC.
Okay, an LLC. And is there one or more than one owner?
More than one.
More than one owner. So from a tax perspective, by default, you would be taxed as a partnership.
Yep.
Your issue, I mean, if you bought equipment and if it's not placed in service, it's not depreciable yet, and then if you know, you bought inventory and you haven't sold it, there's no deduction there. If you have no income and no expense, if you take a look at the Form 1065 instructions for a partnership, there is no need to file. But if there's any income or expense, then you would need to file a 1065. There's another code section I just want to pass by you. It's Section 195, Startup Expenditures. And generally, the IRS will treat you in a startup phase until you've begun business. And when you've begun business is a factual determination. But until you've begun business, Section 195 is a special section that governs those startup expenses. And if they're $5,000 or less, startup expenses can be deducted. If they're more, there's some special rules. So I tip you off on that as well.
All right. There you have it. Good. Thanks, Greg. Thank you very, very much for calling. Let's turn to Bill in Appleton next. Bill, hello.
Good morning. I have a question that I'm going to try and not make too complicated. So if I make it too complicated, interrupt me. My father died in 2008, and the house was held in a revocable trust with my brother, myself, and my sister as successor trustees. Now, I believe at the time he died, we got a step up in basis in the value of that property. We ended up selling it in 2009 for $100,000 less than the fair market value at the time of his death. So I believe this is a $33,000 capital loss for each of us. What do you think?
That one I'd want to check. And I haven't had it for years, that particular issue. Obviously, we're in a different market right now. But clearly, if you have a gain, gain is always taxable. If you have a loss and the property is held for business or for investment, that loss is clearly deductible. And then there's some special rules. If it's a personal use property, for example, if it's your own house and it's personal use property and you have a loss, you cannot deduct that loss. Now, at the date of death, you probably were no longer holding that property for personal use, right? I mean, Dad died, wasn't living it. And then so if you were holding it out for sale or rent, there is a possibility that that took it out of the personal realm into a deductible loss. But I haven't looked at that for some time, but that's the trail you got to go down to see if that's a possibility for you. And it's quite possible, but I'd want to crack a book on that.
Okay.
Is this something you think would really justify professional help?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got it's just a matter of taking a look at your facts, what you did with the house since Dad passed away, to see if that gets you into a situation where you might be entitled to deduct a loss on that. You know, basically, personal use property,
no.
It, there's no loss deductible. But here, you may have taken it out of that by your actions if you had it for sale or for rent. And so that requires just a little research, which, you know, obviously I can't do over the radio here.
Yep. All right. Good luck. Thank you, Bill, for calling. Here's an email from an Appleton listener. As a newcomer to Wisconsin, I'm wondering if I have to file Wisconsin tax forms if I only lived in the state for 1 month in 2009.
Oh, I would bet you do, assuming you had income.
Yeah, if you had income, you probably would.
Yes, and you would file Wisconsin Form 1NPR, and then on that form it lists your total income and items for 2009 per your federal return, and then there's another column to the right of that where you list just your Wisconsin source income. So although you probably have a filing requirement, the tax may not be particularly great, but you still need to do that.
All right, let's turn to Fred in Adams County next. Hi, Fred. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've listened to public radio for a long time. I was contributing. In fact, the company used to manage half of it, but that's gone. Here's the situation, folks. I'm 70-plus, never been sick. I spent three different trips to Marshfield Hospital. I'm looking at a bill that could be 75 to 90. I don't know. Now, my question is...
75 to 90,000?
Well, it could be. Heart surgery. I mean, I don't know because I can't figure out for them. Now, my question to your guest, should I... postpone this. This operation took place on November 20th. I can't seem to get all the final figures. I do have some insurance. Should I postpone this till 210, or can I do that? Or what should I do about the taxes for this year? Is it deductible? And I'll listen to you.
Okay. If you're a cash method taxpayer, which most individuals are, you deduct your expenses when they are paid. So if you haven't paid it yet, you wouldn't be entitled to deduct it. So it's your net payment out of pocket as you pay it that you would get a deduction.
Would that be in two? Could I do that? Use this in 2010 then?
If you pay it in 2010, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so whatever happened, whatever this bill would be for 209, which when I had this terrible surgery, then I can use that in 2010 and just file my 09 taxes as. I would normally.
Yeah. That's right. And that might give you some opportunity to do some tax planning. For example, if I don't know what your other income and deductions are, and you don't obviously have to tell us here over the radio, but if your deductions are going to exceed your income in 2010 because of this unusually largely high medical expenses, it could give you an opportunity, for example, to try to pull other taxable income into your return in 2010 because you may not pay any tax on it. For example, money from retirement accounts or IRAs might be a possibility. So if you end up paying a substantial sum, you may want to do some tax planning for 2010 to get the best tax result you can for yourself.
Absolutely.
So I could delay that till 2010 then.
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks very much for calling. And if you, as Steve said, you got some potential opportunity there. So think about that. Suzanne in Rice Lake, we're on to you now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Due to a job loss, we own a home here that we've had on the market and we're trying to sell. My husband lost his job in 08 and had to rent an apartment through 09 because the company he works for is 4 hours away. And so we were wondering if that apartment rental would be deductible on our taxes.
Was a job a permanent job?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, there's a concept that's known as tax home. And, for example, if you regularly work in Madison, for example, but you go to work in Denver for 3 months on a temporary assignment, okay, during that temporary assignment, you would be in a travel status and entitled to deduct your travel expenses. But when you have a permanent job, even though it's away from your existing residence, going back from your home to that job is non-deductible commuting, and your tax home is generally associated with where you regularly work. In your husband's case now, it was in a different city, and therefore you wouldn't be in a travel status, and the rent would just be a personal non-deductible expenditure.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Take a look. If you want to take a look, Form 2106 is where you would deduct employee business expenses, but the instructions to that form, which you can get on IRS.gov, they have a discussion of that tax home concept that you might find helpful. And then there's also a publication, 463, that might help you out. But I suspect you're going to find yourself, though, in a non-deductible situation with respect to that house.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Laura emailed us and just with a general question. She said, I'm just wondering why I have to include the amount I add to my Roth IRA on my taxes. This is my personal account, not one that is through an employer. This is all taxed income that is put into the account, and I'm not drawing on it. I'm 32 and have many years left before I retire. Why do they need to know what I am contributing? That's a good question.
Oh, so, I mean, there's no addition she adds to her income on her tax return. She just simply makes a non-deductible Roth IRA contribution.
Yeah.
On the Roth, it's possible if you take the funds out too soon, you might need to know your basis in that. So it's a way to keep track of your basis. But I don't read the opening sentence there again, Larry.
She says she pays Roth IRA. She adds to her Roth IRA and her taxes. This personal account is not one that's through my employer. This is all taxed income that is put into the account, and I'm not drawing on it, on the IRA. So why does the government need to know what I am contributing?
Oh, another reason is there are limits. So that you'll get a form showing what you contributed, and for an individual under age 50, the maximum amount you can put in is $5,000. If you're 50 or older, then it's $6,000 for 2009. But so the government also wants to monitor that you don't put in more than you're eligible to put in.
Okay.
In any given year, I mean, you know, if you had $50,000 and you can put it in a Roth IRA, that'd be pretty nice deal.
Yeah.
But they monitor that, and if you put in more than you're eligible for, which could be less if you had less earned income, there are excess contribution penalties that apply as well. So the government monitors that you don't put in more than you're eligible to. So that's probably the biggest issue there.
All righty. Bob in Madison, let's turn to you now. We'll turn to you in just a minute, Bob. I got to remind everybody here that Steve Schmidt's our guest. Steve is a Certified Public Accountant, Managing Director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking tax preparation today with Steve Schmidt, and we'll go right to the phones now. And Bob and Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yes, thanks. I was wondering if you could say a bit about what I understand is the temporary rules for converting traditional IRAs into Roth IRAs, and whether you could tell me the form numbers and the form names that I could use to sort of calculate what my tax would be on the actual tax form.
Sure. There's a new rule that applies starting in 2010, and that rule is this. Prior to 2010, you could not convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA or from other retirement accounts to a Roth IRA if your adjusted gross income exceeded $100,000, okay? That rule is lifted. Anybody, even though their income is higher than $100,000 starting in 2010, can convert funds from other qualified retirement plans to Roth IRAs. Secondly, there's a special rule, is if you do that conversion in 2010, the taxable income amount can alternatively be reported on your 2010 tax return if you wish, or you can report half in 2011 and half in 2012. All right? So that's what is new. And many people should consider the Roth conversion. Right now in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin law as it sits today has not adopted those same federal provisions. As I understand it, there's legislation pending that would effectively adopt those federal provisions for Wisconsin as well. But so if you're a Wisconsin resident, you may want to wait until we get the Wisconsin rules aligned with federal before you do so. If not, if you're under age 59 and a half, there's a premature withdrawal penalty, and then you're putting, and that'd be a one-shot penalty, and then on an ongoing basis, there'd be an excess contribution to a Roth for Wisconsin that would be a penalty each and every year. So we fully expect that Wisconsin's going to get its law changed and will accommodate the Roth conversion as well, but it's not on the books yet.
When you say 2010, does that mean when I file in 2010, or did
you have to actually convert it in 2010.
So if I convert it now, but I would still put it on my 2009 tax?
No, 2010.
Oh, okay, so I don't have to deal with this year at all. I just wait this year.
So if you didn't convert by December 31st, 2009, it'll be a 2010 transaction if you convert in 2010.
Okay. All right.
There's no, like, you can make an IRA contribution by April 15th and deduct it on your prior year return. There's no rule like that for conversions. Conversions have to happen by December 31st, 2009, or they're not a 2009 transaction.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Scott in La Crosse next. Scott, hello.
Hi. Thanks so much. My question involves a savings bond that I had last year that reached maturity. So I cashed it through my credit union, and I have a statement here, my credit union tax statement, interest statement on the 1099 shows one box for my regular interest, and then one box, it says interest on U.S. savings bonds and treasury obligations. And I guess my question is, on filing my taxes now, where do I count for that one, that amount from the savings bond? Do I use the 1040A? So do I put it on Schedule 1 and just list it as savings bond, or where does that go?
Let's see. I thought there was, I don't do much in 1040A work, but isn't there a schedule now? Don't you use Schedule B on 1040A? Have you looked at the 2009? 1040A?
And
I thought they were using, how large is it?
You mean the amount?
The amount.
$179.
Okay, so that's a small threshold amount. But it would be taxable on the federal return.
Oh, I see. Yeah, Schedule B.
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is. Okay.
Right.
I listed there.
And then on Wisconsin, it's not taxable. If it's U.S. source interest, it is not taxable on the Wisconsin return. And if you file a Wisconsin Form 1, there's a line to subtract the interest on it's line 7. Now, I don't have a Form 1A in front of me, but if it's possible that if there's no line, you might have to file Form 1. But it should not be taxable on the Wisconsin return.
Great. And I just listed on the Schedule B as savings bond interest?
Yes.
Oh, terrific. All right. Great.
Thank you very much for calling, Scott. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Kate in Milwaukee next. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have a question about whether I need to file a Wisconsin state return. I have income from out of state. I currently live in Wisconsin.
Are you a Wisconsin resident or not?
Resident.
You're a Wisconsin resident.
I'm a Wisconsin resident.
Okay.
My only earned income is from North Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And I do have some unearned income. So I'm wondering, do I just file a North Dakota tax return or both?
Yeah. Was North Dakota, was that income subject to withholding?
Yes.
It was wages or?
Yes, wages.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Were you working in North Dakota or working in Wisconsin when you earned those wages?
Working and living in North Dakota. But I now live in Wisconsin where I've had no earned income.
Okay.
But
so,
I do have unearned income also, interest and some dividends.
Yeah. When you were working in, you said, North Dakota.
Yes.
Were you a resident of North Dakota? Or were you in Wisconsin for years, you went to work in North Dakota for 7 months, and then you came back to Wisconsin?
Yes. I've always filed. I lived there a year.
You lived in North Dakota for a year?
Yes.
Okay.
But I always considered myself a Wisconsin resident.
All right.
It was a temporary situation.
There you go. Okay, that's good. So you didn't abandon your Wisconsin domicile. So you continued
no.
to be a Wisconsin resident while you lived in North Dakota. I mean, that's key. All right, then here's what you need to do. Wisconsin taxes you on your worldwide income, including the North Dakota income earned while you were working in North Dakota. North Dakota will tax you on that because you were physically out there working. But Wisconsin will grant you relief. They'll give you a full credit for the tax you pay on that North Dakota earnings. So what you should do is file a non-resident North Dakota return, file a Wisconsin resident return, and then there's a Wisconsin Schedule OS where you'll claim a tax credit for the amount of your liability, your North Dakota tax liability shown on your 2009 North Dakota tax return.
Okay, all right. So in North Dakota, file as a non-resident, file
mm-hmm.
Wisconsin as a resident, and also use Form OS.
To claim a credit on your Wisconsin Form 1. I'm looking at a Form 1 right now, and the credit goes on line 32 of page 2 of Form 1. And then you enclose Schedule OS, and then you need to include a copy of your North Dakota return. If you file it in paper, you just attach the North Dakota return along with the Wisconsin return. If you file it electronically, you have to separately mail the North Dakota return with a Wisconsin schedule called RA.
Okay.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah. A lot to think about there. Good thing you called, Kate. Thanks a lot for calling.
RA. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll take some more calls. Email from Maggie, who's actually from Preston, Minnesota. Last year, I recalled you shared a way to deduct travel expenses to and or from work if you had a work-related stop errand to make as part of the commute. Can you remind me again about the limitations to this and how we report it?
Well, for example, if you have an office and home normally going back and forth, that's personal non-deductible commuting. But let's say today, instead of going from home to the office, you go from home to a client, and then from the client to the office. That there would be legitimate business interest, not interest, I mean mileage, okay?
Okay.
Not non-deductible personal commuting. So if you're an employee, you include the deduction for business use of a car, or you can take actual expenses or the standard mileage allowance on Form 2106.
2106, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go to Kathy in Stoughton now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. My question has to do with my parents. They collect Social Security, and their Social Security plus a little bit of interest only comes to about $37,000, but they did a rollover on their traditional IRA to the Roth, like you were talking about before, and that was about $7,000. My question is, do they need to file federal taxes? Because I think their standard deduction will take care of that that rollover.
So you got $7,000. How much was the interest, roughly?
The interest was $1,600.
$1,600.
And Social Security was around $35.
Yeah, and $35. You take half of Social Security, would be $17. That'd be $24. So it looks like none of their Social Security would be taxable either. Once you get beyond $32,000 in total income, which is half of Social Security plus other sources of income, then some of Social Security may be taxable. You're right, but it looks like their gross income will not exceed the filing requirement, which would be 11. What? It's 11.4 for the standard deduction. Plus, they got at least two personal exemptions of $36.50 each. So that's what, $7,300, $18,700, and then if they're over 65, you still have an additional amount. So it certainly looks like their income would be under the filing requirement.
Okay, my concern was that since they did that rollover, that they would have to file no matter what. But it's all based on how much income they have.
Yes,
correct?
Right, okay. Right. Now, if they're over 59 and a half, obviously, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but if you go to irs.gov, and if you go to the 1040 instructions, there is a little chart early in those instructions that says who must file.
Page 8.
It's page 8? All right, you got it. Okay, so you're there. So you can just kind of follow that down and just, you know, do the math and make sure. I guess the other thing you might want to do is go to the Social Security taxation worksheet to make sure none of the Social Security is going to be taxable.
Mm-hmm.
Based on what you told me, I don't believe it would be.
Okay.
But if that's the case, then it looks like you're going to be under the threshold for federal. You might want to just pull the Wisconsin Form 1 instructions, do the same thing. There's a little chart in there, who must file.
Okay.
All right.
Is that going to be an issue for the state tax, considering what you had told the gentleman before about the rollover from the traditional IRA to the Roth still being a problem?
No, because they had less than $100,000 of income, right? So
okay.
They were eligible
yeah.
Under the old rules, so no problem with that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for your help.
Yep.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. Another email from Jeffrey. Would you discuss the making work pay deduction credit and the deduction for real estate taxes as a portion of the standard deduction on the main 1040?
Okay, the making work pay is a credit. It's not a deduction. And there's a new Schedule M that you need to complete to compute that. And basically what it is 6.2% of your earned income.
Okay.
But it cannot exceed $400 for a single taxpayer or $800 on a joint return. And then if your income exceeds certain levels, it's phased out. For a single taxpayer, it's phased out with between $75,000 and $95,000 of income. And on a joint return, the credit is phased out from $150,000 to $190,000 of income. So if you have more than $95,000 of income as a single taxpayer or $190,000 as married filing jointly, you'll get no making work pay credit.
Okay.
So fill out Schedule M, and that'll walk you right through it. Now, with respect to real estate taxes.
Yeah.
For last year and this year, for 2008 and 2009 only, if you do not itemize and you pay real estate taxes on your principal residence, then you can deduct the amount of real estate taxes you paid up to $500. You can increase your standard deduction by up to $500 on a single return or $1,000 on a joint return. To do that, there's a new Schedule L this year, which you should complete, which will walk you through. Here's your basic standard deduction, and then here's your additional amount, which it could be an additional amount for three different reasons. The real estate tax deduction, which we just discussed. There's a new motor vehicle sales tax deduction if you bought the car on or after February 17th and before December 31st if you don't go over certain income limits. And the third one, if you have certain disaster losses. So those are the three special additions to the standard deductions that might apply to some of our listeners.
All right. Let's take another email here. I retired a year and a half ago and plan to sell my farm and buy a smaller house. The purchase price will most likely be less than the amount I will sell the farm for. I have lived in my current location for nearly 22 years. Will I have to pay capital gains tax on the difference?
Okay. The farm, you're likely going to need to break the farm into two elements. The personal residence part.
Okay.
And the business part, or the farm part. On the personal residence, if you lived there for at least 2 out of 5 years before the sale as your principal residence, up to $250,000 of gain is excludable from income on a single return or on a joint return where both husband and wife meet the ownership and occupancy requirements, the 2 out of the 5 years, you can exclude up to $500,000 of gain. On the business part, whatever the selling price properly allocable to that compared to your tax basis is going to be taxable. The question kind of inferred the old rule. If you sell a house and replace it with one costing more than the selling price of old, you don't have to pay tax on the gain. That's no longer in the law. That's history. So it's just you can exclude up to $250,000 or $500 of gain. On the federal return, if it's long-term capital gain, there's special tax rates. The maximum rate will be 15%. On Wisconsin reduced its long-term capital gain exclusion from 60% to 30% effective January 1st, 2009. However, there's a special rule for farm assets, which this listener may want to check out, where it continues on at 60% for eligible farm property.
Okay. All right. Is there, and here's another email, excuse me, is there an age when I do not have to pay taxes on my Social Security? I'm 64 now.
No. Social Security, the taxation of Social Security isn't age-based. It's income-based. For a single taxpayer, if half your Social Security plus other income exceeds $25,000, or on a joint return, if that same amount exceeds $32,000, part of your Social Security will be taxed. So it's not age-based, it's income-based.
Income-based, okay.
Then on Wisconsin, however, recently they fully excluded the taxation of Social Security. So on the Wisconsin return, Social Security generally is exempt.
Let's turn to Mark in Green Bay next. Mark, hi.
Hi, I have some questions. To start off with, I'd like to know, are taxes the people pay or when they receive income like selling stocks or bonds? Is all that stuff open to the public somehow?
Those records? Not that I know of, no.
Okay.
Your personal income tax returns are not open for public inspection.
So if a person received, like, if somebody transferred stocks over to them, you wouldn't, there's no way of knowing or, you know, that they'd have to pay taxes on or something that's considered an income, so it's private?
Well, if you have stocks or accounts in your name and your Social Security number, the interest in dividend and any sale proceeds will be reported out to the IRS, the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, and you on relevant forms 1099. So those amounts are subject to reporting. Now, the public doesn't get those, but the payor of interest or dividends or the broker who handles a sale transaction has to report those transactions both to you and the taxing authorities.
Okay. Well, you answered my question. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And here's a question from Gina, who says in 2009, she's a Wisconsin resident working in Minnesota. In 2009, with the reciprocity agreement, do I need to file both Minnesota and Wisconsin taxes or just Minnesota, since those were the only taxes I paid?
You got a problem there. If you're a 2009, you're a Wisconsin resident working in Minnesota, there's reciprocity. So Minnesota income taxes should not have been withheld. Wisconsin should have. Since the withholding was erroneous, she's going to need to file in both states. She's going to need to file in Minnesota to get all the withholding tax back on the Minnesota wages while she was a Wisconsin resident, because they're not taxable in Minnesota because of reciprocity. In Wisconsin, she's a Wisconsin resident, so she needs to report those wages to Wisconsin and pay tax on it. Unfortunately, she may have an underpayment penalty because there was no withholding. I want to mention that effective January 1st, 2010, Minnesota terminated the reciprocity agreement with Minnesota.
With Wisconsin?
With Wisconsin. Minnesota terminated, reciprocity with Wisconsin. So that no longer applies. There's some discussion. They're trying to resurrect it. But as of the moment, there is no reciprocity with
Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Right.
Sue and Wausau, we're on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding HSA. In 2009, I started out the year with an individual health insurance plan, high deductible, along with an HSA. I did not make any contributions to that HSA, but I did pay out some medical bills in January of 2009. In November of 2009, I was employed with a company that now offered health insurance. So November, December, I have their health insurance, and that is not eligible for an HSA because it's not a high deductible plan. So what I want to do is just leave that HSA intact and not take any money from it, but I want to leave it for future use because probably the way things are going, health insurance, I'll need a high deductible plan again at some point and then an HSA. Would the IRS allow me to just leave that HSA dormant?
Sure.
Or are they going to they will.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
No problem.
I've been looking through the IRS publications on HSAs, and I cannot find this situation. Do you know specifically where I could look to find that?
Oh, let's see. If you go to Form 8889, did you look at that and the instructions?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. That would be the starting point. And then I would expect that those forms, that might reference Publication 969.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a possibility for you. That's referenced right in the Form 8889 instructions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would suggest.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Steve Schmidt, certified a public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And if you have a question about your taxes, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's go to Greg in Wausau next. Greg, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple things real quick. I put a tankless water heater in the house mid-year, and I also put a wood stove in, but that was mid-January. Now, I kind of know what I need, the information I need for the tankless water heater, but I didn't get anything for the stove. I think that was prior to them creating that law for that credit. And then one other thing real quick, I donated a car on January 1st to Rawhide or whoever it was, and I got a receipt, but there's no dollar value amount, and I never found out what it was sold for. So they asked me what I was going to try to claim for it, and they said they just sent me a receipt. So I don't know if I'm missing things or what I'm going to need. I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I think the first issue relates to the residential energy credits. Form 5695, there are energy credits that apply for 2009 and 2010. So water heaters meeting certain efficiency standards are eligible, and the credit is 30% of the cost up to a maximum credit of 30%. And for a water heater, it's not only the cost of the water heater, but the labor cost to install it would be an eligible cost.
Okay.
So you just need to make sure, for any of the residential energy credits, you need to make sure you meet the energy efficiency requirements. And basically for natural gas and oil and water heaters, you need to make sure that you meet those standards. I don't know what they're off the top of my head, but the Form 5695 will discuss that. With respect to the contribution on the car, if you did that in 2010, he said it was January, the entity will give you a Form 1098-C on or before, like, January 31st or February 15th, 2011, which should help you with what you can deduct with respect to that. But that may come a little bit later.
All right. Let's move on. Marcia in Milwaukee, it's your turn now. Hi, Marcia.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about what we need to do on our tax forms for a mother-in-law who foreclosed on her house last year. And she actually was able, or the bank was able, to complete a short sale on it.
Okay.
So we have no idea, like, what kind of paperwork we're going to get. And that happened in Michigan, and she now lives in Wisconsin. And she's been on unemployment and Head Start collecting her Social Security. So this is kind of all new stuff to us that we've never, put down on forms before. So
yeah,
we're not really sure if we have to do in both states, if there's going to be our house taxes involved.
She did a short sale. So you sold the property before the bank foreclosed on it then?
Yes.
And was the selling price more or less than the mortgage balance?
Way less.
Way less.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then in connection with that, this is a very involved area of tax law. To the extent you received sale proceeds from the house, the sale proceeds compared to your tax basis in the house would be gain or loss. If it's gain and your mother lived there for two out of the last 5 years, you get the gain exclusion of up to $250,000 for a single taxpayer. So that likely would cover any gain,
right?
Assuming she met that requirement.
Yeah.
Then the other part is debt discharge. To the extent that she was personally liable on the home and didn't have to pay it, that's called cancellation of indebtedness income.
Which I think they did, yes.
Yeah. Fortunately for you, it's not a provision I've had to apply myself in my practice yet, but under Section 108, there is an exclusion for cancellation of indebtedness in connection with a home. And so that shouldn't be taxable. The only thing I can't tell you is, since I haven't worked with it, it's excluded from income.
Right.
You know, while what you need to file associated with that, I just haven't had to do myself. But I do know it's excluded from income. So if you go to the IRS package for the Form 1040, I'm sure there's a discussion on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like the gain will be excluded because of the if there is a gain of the exclusion provision, and then the debt discharge, the mortgage balance in excess of the selling price of the home would be excluded under a special provision.
Right, okay.
And then I can't address Michigan law because I don't know how they would treat that.
But I understand.
You'll have to deal with somebody that may know more about Michigan than I do.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Marcia.
Thank you.
Let's turn to John in Madison. John, hello.
Hi. I'll apologize in advance. I'm having trouble framing my situation into a single question. I guess I'm looking to take a financially unsuccessful business and move it into, or to find out what my options might be while still selling my book. I'm an author, for example, and I also have websites where I have a few products, and I also make some small amounts in advertising dollars. But as far as the government is concerned, I'm sure it's financially unsuccessful. If I still have any options to keep the business, to keep doing basically what I'm doing without having the business.
Turn it into a hobby or something?
Hobby, yeah.
Well, the issue, I mean, your concern, there's a code section that is if the IRS views what you're doing is a hobby as opposed to a true activity that you're really trying to make a profit from, they can disallow the loss. And so that's really an inherently factual situation, which goes beyond what we can cover on a radio show such as this. But that's your concern. I mean, that's the issue. I mean, if you're really in it to make a profit, it's just that you haven't been as successful as you'd like to be. You know, there's some possibility that you would be in a position to continue to deduct those losses. But I don't know your particular situation well enough to advise. But there's a code section, it's section 183, that deals specifically with that. And section 183 has a presumption if the gross income derived from an activity for three or more of the taxable years in the period of five consecutive taxable years exceeds the deductions, then there's a presumption you're in it for profit, and it doesn't sound like you would meet that. But that's the governing code section, which could apply to your situation. And I don't know what else I can. If you have any other specific question, perhaps we can try to help you out. But that would be your concern.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for calling. And Jeff in La Crosse, on to you.
Yes, good morning, or almost afternoon now, I guess. I'd like to say thank you for your time. It's very interesting, all your knowledge. I have a question that I'm hoping maybe you could steer me in the right direction. I have a house that, the long and short of it, I purchased from my mother on a land contract, basically made the payments on the house. However, we never registered that land contract, so over the years, we've never really had any kind of help as far as the property tax score or whatever. And to keep the property tax current and stuff, it's quite a... It did get behind when we first bought it, so it created some back taxes, too. To make a long story short, we're probably paying between the regular tax, the current year tax, and catching up almost $10,000 a year, and I'd still do that for the next 4 years. My question is, can you steer me in the right direction on a property like this? It's still physically, I have never registered into my name, although the house is paid for now. Could you steer me in the right direction? My concern is if I can find some kind of help or tax relief on as far as you know, if the IRS sees the expense of the property tax somewhere, and how it would also affect my mother, who is retired, for example, if I actually purchased the house by just paying the taxes all off at once now, would it actually, could I find out somewhere if that would actually qualify as like a first-time homebuyer tax because the land contract was never registered?
Okay. Are you living in this home as your principal residence?
Yes.
Okay. So basically you bought the house from mom under unrecorded land contract. Tax law looks at the beneficial owner of the property, not legal title. So from a tax perspective, I assume you paid your mother for the house, you paid her the principal and the interest. You've been paying expenses on the house ever since. You've had the benefits and the burdens of ownership of that house. So from a tax perspective, I think it's pretty clear that you were the tax owner of that home, even though you didn't have a legal title.
Okay. And we'll take up some additional comments on that in just a few minutes here on the Ideas Network. Talking your income tax returns for 2009 today with Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. Steve, thanks again for being with us today. And I know we had a caller online who had talked about a land contract on a house with his mother. He never really had a written agreement, and you were commenting on the tax situation there.
Sure. As I mentioned, with respect to ownership of the home, he effectively bought that from his mother years ago, and although he never transferred legal title through the unrecorded land contract, he became the tax owner of that home and therefore would be entitled to deduct the real estate taxes during the period of his beneficial ownership as they are paid. And even though he would record legal title in his name now, it wouldn't be a recent purchase eligible for the first-time home buyer credit. Also, there's another problem with that in buying from a related party, so it wouldn't be eligible there for that reason as well.
All right. Let's turn to Julie in Mondovi. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
I'll just straight kind of give you a little bit of background. My husband works in California. He works through union halls to gain employment through contractors that call in for employees. It's a non-benefit, not permanent job. It's whenever the job ends, then he's done. Goes back to any number of union halls wherever there might be work, if it's in a different state or whatever, and then, you know, gains employment through there again. In 08 and 09, he's worked in California. That was the only earned income we had. He also worked in 08. He worked in California and in Texas, but there's no state income tax there. Our Wisconsin is our domicile. That's where we have our home.
Uh-huh.
But he works, actually physically works out there. And, of course, when he works out there, he spends most of his time out there living, too. Sometimes only 8 months out of the year, you know, he'll get laid off or whatever during the latter part of the year. California tax is deducted, and since we have no income in Wisconsin, there's no, you know, Wisconsin tax deducted.
Uh-huh.
I heard you say something about filing an OS Wisconsin form to claim credit for state or tax paid, income tax paid in another state?
Yes, your situation sounds very similar to the caller we had on earlier where she worked temporarily in North Dakota. So, as you stated, you haven't changed, you or your husband haven't changed your domicile from Wisconsin. You're still Wisconsin residents. So, what you would do is you would file a California non-resident return, pay your California tax that's due on the income earned while working in California. Then in Wisconsin, you report all your income from whatever source, including the California wages. And to alleviate the double tax that would otherwise exist, Wisconsin will give you a full tax credit on those wages for the California tax that you paid. It's not the withholding amount. It's the liability per the return, okay?
Yeah.
And to claim that on your Wisconsin return, you file Wisconsin Schedule OS.
There you have it.
Is the he's been doing, you know, working in different states, you know, through like from 2005, but I've never heard about that before. We do have somebody, CPA, do our taxes, but we generally have always paid the double tax.
And oh, boy.
In the last couple of years that have come up, you know, Wisconsin, where we just didn't realize we had owed Wisconsin because we never paid any.
Yeah. Do you have, for example, your 2008 return there?
We haven't filed the 08 return
yet. No, I'm not talking 09, I'm talking 08. But just take a look, like on page 2. There, I don't remember what line, it would be 31, 32, 33, somewhere along there. There would be a credit for taxes paid to another state. If it's not there and you paid California tax and those wages were also included in your Wisconsin return, then you should amend your prior Wisconsin returns to get refunds.
Yes.
4 years would be open. Wisconsin has a 4-year statute of limitation.
And then Wisconsin sent us a thing because they said we should be paying underestimated tax.
Oh, sure. Because you didn't have what, yeah, they hit you with underpayment penalty. My guess is you may be missing a foreign state credit. And if that's the case, that should help you out significantly.
Yeah, you're going to be very happy you looked into that. So I'd probably go to someone else maybe to a different preparer.
Yeah. I must say Wisconsin's a very generous state. They allow you a full credit even though the other state tax rate might be higher than Wisconsin, and California is. So other states would limit it to the lesser of the Wisconsin tax attributable to those earnings or the foreign state tax you paid. But Wisconsin, no matter what it is, it gives you the full credit. So very easy to amend that if that's the only issue on your tax return.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Dave
emailed us, what's the tax liability on inherited monies? In his case, most of was CD savings accounts, $50,000, while about $10,000 was insurance, stock, and retirement IRA.
Sure. Basically, inheritances are received tax-free, with the exception of, for example, you said he had some CDs and so forth.
Yeah.
To the extent there was interest that was earned before death but not paid, those he will have to include in his income.
Okay.
But other than that, it should be income tax free.
All right.
Any income earned before death but not reported by the decedent then is taxable by the heirs when it's received.
Here's another one. Sue wonders, we haven't decided if we're going to convert existing IRAs to Roth. In the meantime, can we open a Roth IRA for 2009? Also fund for 2010 and the earnings would be tax-free?
Yes. I mean, if you're not over the income thresholds for making a Roth IRA contribution, you can do it. You can make a Roth contribution for 2009 as late as April 15th, mm-hmm. and you can make your 2010 contribution right now if you wish. So no problem with that. And the earnings in the account, as long as the money stays in the account, are not taxable.
Let's go to Robin in Green Bay. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently received some stock due to the death of my mother, and it's stock that's been passed down through the generations, and I have no idea what the cost basis is on that.
When you say recently, was that in 2009?
Yes.
Okay, because in 2009 yet, you get a date of death fair market value for the inherited stock. So you don't need to worry about what the original cost was. If you received it as a result of your mother's death, you take a tax basis equal to the date of death value.
Okay. And if it occurs in 2010?
Well, we're not sure yet. Congress, basically, theoretically, the estate tax, right now as it stands, is repealed for 2010,
and you get carryover basis, but there's an exception for a certain amount of property. I don't really think we're going to end up there. I think we're going to end up with more rules similar to what applied in 2009, but we have to wait and see what Congress does.
All right. There you have it, Robin. Thank you. Vicki and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Listen, my question regards like-kind tax provision. We currently own a piece of lake property that was gifted to us, so we got a relatively low market value when we first owned the property, and now it's gone up exponentially. So we have also, my husband got a new job, and we're living out of, going to be living out of the area. We want to be able to be close enough to this, to the property to be able to maintain it. It does have a small cabin on it, but the value of that is very little. So my question is, what kind of property would the IRS consider like kind if we were to use that provision in finding a
sure.
similar property? And
okay, with respect to like kind and real estate, it's very broad. As long as it's U.S. real estate for U.S. real estate, it can be land for land. It can be land for an apartment building, an office building, almost anything.
It wouldn't necessarily have to have a lake frontage on it?
No, not at all.
Really?
Real estate like kind is very broad. But I would caution you on one thing: in order for the like kind exchange provisions to apply, both the property you give up in the exchange and the property you receive in the exchange that you acquire has to be held for investment or for use in trade or business or rental. So if either property on either end, the property relinquished or the property acquired, is personal use property, the like-kind exchange provisions don't apply.
Okay. Now, the property that we currently owned at one point, like for retirement, we were planning on building out there.
Mm-hmm.
What about the new property? Would that no longer be an available option?
Well, you need to determine if you're holding the lake property right now for personal purposes, you don't qualify under 1031.
Okay.
And
well,
even if you
not
acquire,
really. I mean, that's
if
not
you're
our
holding it for investment, gee, I think it's a good investment. It's going to go up in value.
Mm-hmm.
You don't use it, you know, as for personal purposes. All you do is, you know, you're holding it for investment. Then an investment purpose is eligible for a like-kind exchange. So you need to determine what your holding purpose is.
I see. Okay.
And
all right.
If it's investment, business, or rental, 1031 applies. If it's solely personal use,
it doesn't.
Then 1031 does not apply. So the like-kind exchange provisions do not apply.
All right.
If it was farming?
Farming is a business. So
the farming would apply,
mm-hmm.
as long as there wasn't a personal residence there or anything.
The personal residence part wouldn't apply, but if you used it as your principal residence, you might come under the gain exclusion provisions for a personal residence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. We have another email. My mother may be going into a nursing home and will have to cash in stocks to pay the bill. She will need to claim taxes. Will she need to claim taxes on this next year? She's about $30,000 in stocks, and it would be 2010.
Yeah, basically, the sale of the stock would be reportable on Schedule D, and you report your gain or loss. But it sounds like she would be using those proceeds for paying medical expenses. If she's going to a nursing home,
right.
Chances are all or the great majority of what she will be paying would probably be qualifying medical expenses, which could be deducted on Schedule A as a medical expense, in which case it's quite possible, although the sale is taxable, it may be offset with itemized deductions for medical expenses, and you end up paying no tax on the gain.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Menasha, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have two quick questions, at least I hope they're quick. The first one is on a 401k at my employer. Does it apply towards the Savers Tax Credit?
Yes.
And how do I get it?
Yeah, the Savers Tax Credit, you have to have quite low income, and you get it by filing a Form 8880, and on a single return, your total adjusted gross income has to be less than $27,750. On a married filing joint return, your income has to be less than $55,500. And the form has a little chart which
The maximum credit is 55% of or 50% of $2,000 or $1,000, but then as income goes up, the credit gets phased out.
Okay. All right.
And then the second one is the Form 1099-G on the tax return for the previous year.
Yes.
Do you have to file that, or what's the deal with that?
You don't file it. That's where the state is reporting to you how much a refund you received. If you itemized your deductions on your 2008 tax return and received benefit from the deduction, then all or part of the tax refund must be included in 2009 income.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And an email from Jenny. My daughter and I attended a mission trip with our parish last summer. Our youth group raised most of the money to cover the expenses, but each participant had to pay $150 each toward expenses. Is this $150 tax deductible as a charitable contribution?
Sounds like it to me. As long as the entity or the organization that you were benefiting was a qualifying charity, out-of-pocket expenses incurred in connection with serving in a charitable capacity are deductible as charitable contributions.
All right. On to Joey in Rhinelander. Hi, Joey.
Hi. I have a question. I purchased a piece of property in 2009 and used the first-time homebuyer's credit in 2008. Since then, I'm going to be forced to move to an apartment closer to where I can find a job. I was wondering what any repercussions may be since I took advantage of that credit.
Yeah, if you sell within 36 months, you're subject to recapture. But if you don't make any profit on the house, the recapture tax is limited to your gain on the sale of the house. Get Form 5405 and the related instructions, and that should help you out in reporting that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Jamie in River Falls, on to you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I sold a house after 10 years in August of 2009, and I purchased the house in September of 2009. And I was wondering, am I eligible for any type of credit?
And you bought September 2009?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, under the old credit provision, you had to be a first-time home buyer, okay,
mm-hmm.
And that meant you didn't own a home within 36 months of buying the new home. And then effective in November 7th,
mm-hmm.
if you were a long-term homeowner, that is, you owned a home for at least 5 years out of the last eight, then those individuals, instead of an $8,000 credit, are eligible for a credit of up to $6,500. But it sounds like you bought your home too early.
September 7th.
Yes. It has to be November 7th, 2009 through April 30th, 2010. Or as long as you have a binding contract by April 30th, 2010, you can close as late as June 30th, 2010.
Well, I fell through the cracks there.
It sure looks that way.
Oh, well, thank you.
Timing right. Is everything, huh?
Oh, boy. Here's another email. My son worked in New Zealand during the last year. It worked from January through December, so the whole year. What taxes would he need to file in the U.S.?
Okay. The U.S. Taxes your worldwide income, so there's no question he'll need to file a U.S. income tax return, and likely his state of residence, his domicile, probably didn't change either, so a state return as well. On the federal return, there is an earned income exclusion, which you might want to check out. Look at Form 2555 and the related instructions to see if you meet the requirements for excluding foreign earned income.
All right. Let's go to Ted in Appleton now. Hi, Ted.
Good afternoon. Nice program.
Thank you.
I have a question on if there is a time limit for taking a capital gains loss.
Well,
you mean you have capital
I made
losses.
An investment in a company and was around 10 years ago, and the company has since gone bankrupt.
Okay. When did it go bankrupt?
Probably about 2004.
Oof. When an investment becomes totally worthless, you're treating it as having sold it as of December 31st of the year in which it becomes worthless. 2004 would have been 2005. 3 is 8 years, boy. The only thing I can think of, did you know it was worthless as of the end of 2004?
No, I did not.
Because you get a factual determination of when the worthlessness was discovered, okay?
Okay.
Also, there's mitigation provisions.
Mm-hmm.
If for some reason you don't get a deduction when you otherwise should have taken it, and you meet about 4 different requirements, which are too detailed to go on the radio here. There are mitigation provisions which effectively hold the statute of limitations open for you. So if you've got a sizable loss, what I would suggest you do is, gather your facts together and see if you can't find a qualified practitioner in your area to help you out.
There is a time limit then, and what is that?
Well, normally for federal, you can amend a return within 3 years.
Okay.
And Wisconsin is 4 years.
Okay.
All right. But as I said, at least on the federal side, there's statute limitation mitigation provisions which might help you out. I'll give you the code sections. It's section 1311, 12, 13, 14. And obviously we can't go over those on the radio here.
Yeah.
But there are provisions that might be beneficial for you.
All right. Thanks, Ted. Cliff and Silver, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I'm in trucking, and I'm wondering, can I deduct my empty miles, and if so, at what rate?
Okay, so miles.
I'm not
sure. So you're traveling someplace. You unload your truck, and then you drive back. And
sure. I mean, all your expenses for operating your business compared to your income would be deductible. And again,
okay.
Going back with an empty truck would is not a problem.
All right, because I use a CPA, and he says no. So,
no.
But I have, other guys, their CPAs say yes. So,
no. I mean, you're an independent contractor?
Yes.
And you own your own truck?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, somebody pays you for hauling this load from City A to City B, and then you got to bring your truck back to City A to get the next load.
Yeah.
I don't know why they wouldn't all be business.
Yeah. Sounds like a business to me. It sounds like a deduction to me. So there you have it, Cliff. Thank you very much for calling. And, Steve, boy, I don't know how many people we talked to today, but you talked to a lot of people. Thank you so much. And
always my pleasure. Always enjoy your program, Larry.
And, well, we'll look forward to your next visit in about a month or so, I hope.
All right. I'll be back.
All right. Thank you very much. Steve Schmidt, certified public accountant and a managing director in the Madison office of RSM McGladrey. He does a great job, doesn't he? Man, I don't know how he keeps it all in his head. But I feel we're lucky to have him, and he'll be back in a month, and we will talk with him again. Just to let you know about tomorrow, Reggie McLeod, publisher of Big River Magazine, will be talking with us about Asian carp, maybe as a delicacy and to eat. And Greg Lawless and Lois Fetterman of the Department of Ag will talk with us about Thrive, the campaign to sell Wisconsin-made foods in our grocery stores. Stay with us.